This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Today's guest is the writer Kat Rosenfield. She's been on before. She's great. She wrote a novel with Stan Lee a couple years ago. Her new mystery novel, No One Will Miss Her, has been nominated for an Edgar Allan Poe Award, which is the highest honor in that genre. She's also authored a fantastic recent essay in Reason about the cultural staying power of The Matrix, the 1999 movie that introduced the concept of being red-pilled, or being made aware of the dark ways the world and power really work. It's hard to overstate the long-tail impact of The Matrix on popular and political culture, she writes. It has left a vast imprint on everything from action movies to fashion to how we understand technology. We're going to talk about her novel and The Matrix, and we're also going to talk about the recent controversy she's found herself in after going on CNN to critique legacy media's attacks on podcaster Joe Rogan for spreading misinformation about COVID-19. Despite her critical comments about the way CNN and other outlets were demonizing Spotify and podcasting, rabid Rogan fans started attacking Rosenfield as if she were sticking up for the old media. The result is a dark, even dank look at how discourse degenerates on social media. But before we get to all that, I want to introduce you to one of today's sponsors, the Longtime Academy. This is a new podcast about how to be a good ancestor. It's a show about time and how we think about time, and it proceeds from the idea that short-term thinking can be stressful. Some of us find it difficult to plan for tomorrow or next week, let alone next year or 10 years from now. The producers believe long-term thinking can help with that, especially if you've ever felt unproductive, exhausted, or worried about the future. If you're anxious about climate change or partisan politics, if you feel powerless to change the path our world, your world, is on, the Longtime Academy can help. You're going to hear from people like Brian Eno, Celeste Headlee, George the Poet, Roman Krznarik, Jay Griffiths, and Adrian Marie Brown, and you're going to learn how they embrace long-term thinking. The Longtime Academy is an audio documentary, but it also includes practical exercises designed to expand your sense of time, and it's going to help you to become a good ancestor for the folks who hopefully come after us. I checked out an early episode of the Longtime Academy that featured Brian Eno. He's a really great musician, super innovative and provocative. He's been in a ton of bands and worked with a bunch of artists I like. I really liked the episode. I really dug it, and I think you may too. So search for the Longtime Academy anywhere you listen to podcasts. Its slogan sums up its appeal. Life is short, time is long. So check out the Longtime Academy. And now, here's the Reason interview with Kat Rosenfield. Kat Rosenfield, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, so let's start with setting the scene when The Matrix first came out. It's 1999. We're liberated from history because the end of the Cold War had happened a few years before, and apartheid, all sorts of things. They're all in the rearview mirror. There's a massive stock market boom going on. There's the rise of the internet and the web to mass media levels, and that changed a lot of stuff. There's also, you know, some freaky stuff going on. People were, you know, insane about Y2K, and everything was going to stop. Planes were going to drop from the air. I don't know if you were, conscious during 1999, but people were also eating colloidal silver, which was some kind of hedge against precious bodily fluids being infected. It was a lot of weird stuff. There were riots over globalization, even as, you know, everybody was like, okay, we're past history. There was a lack of national unity and identity. The Weekly Standard, which still existed at that time, people there and people like John McCain were talking about, we need national greatness because everybody's just doing their own thing. And then lefties in particular were hating on Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton because they felt like they had, you know, gone to the middle and they were neocons or something like that. So there was a lot of positive stuff going on, you know, just incredibly positive, like world historical levels of positive things, also some bad things. That's kind of the backdrop. So then we get to what your essay in Reason was about.
Why is The Matrix?
I
was just going to say, you know, that was the backdrop for you. And it's interesting to hear that perspective on things because you were saying, you know, was I conscious? I existed.
Okay. How old were you? What year were you born?
I was born in 1982. So The Matrix came out my senior year of high school. So my perspective was not so much aware of how it played against this backdrop of everything that was going on in the world. I was just a teenager at the mall that was about 30 minutes away from my extremely rural hometown.
Where did you grow up?
On the weekends. Cooksaki, New York. Unless you know somebody in prison, you probably have.
I know a lot of people in prison. I don't brag about it, but I'm not very familiar with upstate New York prisons.
You're more of like a deep South prison guy.
Yeah, pretty much. Yes, in fact, that's true. So you're in a small town. You're going to the mall.
We're driving 30 minutes to the mall to hang out and. And see movies at the multiplex there. And, there are these cardboard displays out, and there are previews ahead of the movies. And for months, we're seeing what is the Matrix? And it's this mystery. And everyone was just excited. There was this sense of nobody has any idea what this is. And I mean, because it was the internet existed, but all it really was AOL at that point, for a young person. You might be using Instant Messenger, but this idea of virtual reality, virtual space, even of second identities that you have online, that was really in its infancy. So there was just all of this mystery and all of this excitement. There was no such thing as viral marketing at that time.
I guess the other thing, I can't remember now, did the Matrix come out before or after the Blair Witch Project?
I think it was...
It's like around the same time, right?
I think it was after. I can't be sure. But the Blair Witch Project was an interesting example, too, of how pre-internet the excitement and the mystery around something like that could build. I mean, a lot of people, including people who I knew who were not stupid, thought that the Blair Witch Project was real. And it was terrifying.
Yeah. No, that was fantastic. And the Matrix participates in that kind of sense of mystery, right? Because you're just seeing, I'm assuming, what were the cardboard cutouts like? Because I'm trying to remember where I was when I saw The Matrix, and it might have been in small town Ohio. But, I mean, was it like, was it Morpheus and Neo and Trinity all in their, like, leather gear in a cutout or something?
I'm not even certain that they showed who was in it.
Right.
I mean, it was very, I believe that the thing that you heard in the trailer was Morpheus saying, nobody can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself. But there was all of this, it was like code. There would be code on the posters and you did not understand what it was you were looking at. Of course, because the idea that he had been living in a simulation, that was, I mean, even though it comes in quite early in the movie, it was a plot twist. Nobody knew that that was the case.
Right.
So, yeah. So, I mean, for me, what The Matrix represented primarily was something unlike any movie I'd ever seen before, an experience unlike anything I'd ever had pop culture-wise before.
So part of the reason it's important, because like I'm still thinking about it, and I'm 20 years older than you, you're still thinking about it. What is it like for you, I guess, and I really have to recommend everybody to read this essay. It's up online for free at Reason. Was it that you could go into a different world, that you could create an avatar of yourself, even if we didn't call it quite that or anything? What for you immediately, there's the anticipation of the movie, then you see it, why does it still have its hooks in you?
For me, the way that it looked, more than anything else, it's the way the action scenes were shot visually, it really resonated with me. Now, I have friends for whom the message of the film was really resonant. I talk about this in the essay a little bit, but I had this one guy friend who was kind of a dork. We saw the movie together. And then I came back from college to visit him, and he picked me up at the bus station. And when he walked in, he had been transformed. He walked in. I feel like I remember this scene like it happened in slow motion. And we were in this Albany bus station, which was
so really the cutting edge of the future. You know, the future is a bus station in Albany.
Right. It looked like a setting out of The Matrix, complete with the kind of bleak fluorescent lighting and these people all kind of sitting around like drones, you know, maybe sleeping or on drugs. And he came in through these double doors that slid apart to reveal him in a trench coat that was kind of flying out behind him, one of these like floor length dusters, combat boots, sunglasses at night. And he looked cool as hell. It was insane. I mean, now we look at it and we think, well, maybe this was a little silly, but at the time it was like, oh my God, total transformation.
So he got a transformation out of it, right?
You
were saying, you mentioned then, and this is in the essay as well, like some of the aesthetics of the movie and the special effects, because it was, if not the first movie, one of the first big movies, and it was a big, big hit to have those kind of super slow motion bullet scenes where people are bending backwards to avoid the bullet that is coming, you know, at bullet speed, but they can slow time down. A lot of kind of steampunky eyeglass, sunglass wear. The leather gear is huge in all of this.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, the whole aesthetic. I mean, obviously, some people really glommed on to that. I'm sure Hot Topic did a booming business that year selling
Isn't
Matrix
Hot Topic
knockoff.
Just the greatest store? I am so mad that it was not around when I was a kid, or at least not in my part of the country.
Really? It doesn't, you don't find it like kind of like a sellout concept of being punk?
Yeah, of course. But punk is all fake anyway. And, you know, but more to the point, it was like, you know, the Disney store for kind of punk and goth stuff. So it's just kind of in your neighborhood mall. It's like, it's a great, it's like the White Zinfandel of, you know, goth or something. It's the starter wine.
Right, yeah, and complete with a little bit of light BDSM, which I think, I wonder how many of us who were shopping there, buying things that had all these little straps and buckles on them, actually picked up on the sort of sexual connotations of that. I know that I didn't. I just thought that it was, you know, it was fun looking. It's like, oh, this is extra stuff on my clothes.
Yeah, no, you can hang stuff from it. You know, it's very cool. So, you know, do you remember, you talk about that meeting of your friend, and he has a, you know, he told you a line, and I'm looking for it in my notes right now, but that it's, he said, you know, that it was his girlfriend, you know, who kind of transformed him into a Matrix dude. And then he said, you know, the pull for him, the idea that you could reinvent yourself, that was so cool to me.
Yeah, I didn't realize that he was very aware of himself at the time as being kind of a dork, and was, I think, really, even more than I realized, just kind of, I don't want to say turned on because that makes it sound pervy, and it wasn't, but it was just, you know, it was like a revelation to realize, yes, you know, you can transform yourself in this way.
Yeah. And I mean, Keanu Reeves is an interesting character because he, you know, he's remarkable now, you know, in his mid-50s. He looks pretty good, but we're going to talk about that later because for me, Matrix Resurrections is all about how well Keanu and Carrie Ann Moss have held up. He's kind of a dork, right, in the movie. And Keanu was, you know, he was playing in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. He was, you know, he gets cool in the movie too, right? He transforms into the One. There's that going on.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think that he doesn't register, and I'm, you know, this is my perspective as a heterosexual woman.
We really should just stop the conversation now. You have nothing of interest. You're going to start crying soon, I suspect.
You know, I'm so horny for Keanu Reeves that I'm going to just start sobbing, which is honestly typical for me. It's a daily occurrence.
I do think that Keanu Reeves is near the top of the list of things white people like.
Maybe. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, he has a kind of a, I don't know. I mean, for men too,
exotic,
though.
A little
right?
bit exotic. Yeah, no, he's just a little bit, you know, exotic enough.
But in that movie, he's not a dork in the way that, you know, in a way that is unsexy. He has a kind of an Edward Scissorhands thing going on. You know, he's pale. He's a loner. You know, he's sort of a nerd. But I think that this is one of the things about it, you know, that he provided an entree into this fantasy where you're a nerd and that's what makes you powerful. Your grasp of code or of virtual space makes you powerful. And I think, and I talk about this in the essay, that there's this moment in the movie where Morpheus says, do you think, I can't remember exactly what it is, but he's, you know, he's talking about how fast he is and how strong. And he says, do you think that has anything to do with my muscles in this place? And it was like, imagine, you know, this transcendent idea of sex appeal. It's all about virtual space. It's all about your brain. You don't actually have to know Kung Fu to know Kung Fu. I think that that for a lot of people was really provocative and exciting.
And there is that fascinating shift from, you know, kind of, okay, it, you know, you could be the high school quarterback or, you know, the basketball star if you're a boy and like, you know, you're physical and that's how you get the girl. And then just culturally, yeah, you know, it was like the end of the idea that having brawn was going to get you anywhere. Like you had to have brains, and brains become sexy.
Yes, exactly. And the, you know, the folks with brawn, they were like the sheep, right?
Right.
And you could sort of look down on them.
They're the muscle. They're not even in on the conspiracy, really, right? They're Biff from that's maybe before your time from.
From Back to the Future? I've seen Back to the Future. Okay. What am I, a savage?
Yeah, no, I realize that's an early cinema classic. So I think it's still taught in schools, although, you know, it's probably being canceled for some reason or another. Let me ask you a question, though, then. And, I'm saying this both at the time, and again, older than you, male, heterosexual, I'm the counterpart of you. So really, this is a conversation about two, you know, species that are about to go extinct. But what's the character of Trinity, of Carrie Ann Moss, who is hot as fuck in the movie and is like a kind of powerful woman figure who, you know, can really beat people up and, you know, she can run really fast and jump over buildings too. Where does she fit into your kind of memory of the movie?
That's such an interesting thing because it did not strike me at all that she was... I mean, it did not strike me particularly that she was a woman, which sounds like a weird thing to say. But I think that this is maybe, even a strength of the movie that it just doesn't really care if you're a man or a woman. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of, I mean, it plays into the idea that your physical self, your strength, your muscles are irrelevant in, you know, in the space of the Matrix. There's also the fact that, I mean, although, yeah, you know, Carrie Ann Moss looks amazing in the movie, but she's also...
She's pretty kind of androgynous, even though she's clearly female.
I was going to say androgynous.
You know,
as androgynous as a person can be in, like, skin-tight pleather pants and halter top.
Right. And she's built.
Yes.
I mean, she's not twiggy. Right. You know, she's got a womanly shape.
But she has short hair. She's in good shape.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She has short hair. And, you know, and then also, I guess we can extend that to race in a way. I mean, it's clear that Larry Fishburne, part of his coolness is that he's black, but it's also, it kind of doesn't really matter.
Yeah. I sort of wonder if, you know, I mean, was he there just to kind of coolify these clothes? Like, it's like he's wearing this, so it cannot possibly be dorky. And now we can put all of these sort of like nerdy white folks in the same clothes. And by osmosis, they too will become cool because they're wearing the same outfit as Lawrence Fishburne.
Right. Although I guess he committed for the sequel that came out last fall or around Christmas time. He wasn't really in it, probably because he broke the real cardinal rule of Hollywood is that he got fat. So, you know, I assume that's why he's not in Matrix Resurrections, except kind of in flashbacks.
God, how
have
tragic.
You seen? You know, have so, you seen Matrix Resurrections? By the way,
I started to watch it, so I'll admit that I did not watch it closely. I was making a brisket for dinner. It was Christmas, literally Christmas Day, when we were. It was on, and so I was sort of focused on this big piece of meat, especially as I started realizing that this movie was really silly and not very good.
Yeah, it's kind of a meta commentary on like Hollywood's need to produce sequels, right? For cash, for like to milk cash cows, essentially.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, I understand that maybe there's some pleasure to be had in these sort of like wink nudge moments where they talk about how, oh, you know, we're being forced to make a sequel and so on. But that wasn't enough for me to make it an enjoyable movie. I thought that, I mean, actually, Peter Suderman at Reason wrote a really good review that I think captures what's not really particularly great or compelling about the new Matrix. And one of the things he pointed out was something that I noticed too, which is that the action sequences just kind of fell flat. You know, this is a movie franchise that really cut its teeth on doing something visually remarkable, something people had never seen before. And maybe it was too high a bar to clear this time. I mean, what are the chances of doing that twice? But it felt uninspired in that way.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, it's also interesting, the Matrix, as the other two movies came out to finish the original trilogy, by the third one, I think everybody was like, please make this stop. You know, like, we need like 20 years between between this and whatever comes next. Do you think that, I mean, it's kind of on the nose, but like the whole idea that, you know, in the Matrix world, the machines have kind of revolted and taken over so that we are all slaves to our machines. And that, you know, is a kind of obvious allegory, both for, you know, just industrialization generally, but then the shift into a computer age where, you know, now instead of being chained to an assembly line, people are sitting at their desks typing away or, you know, doing kinds of stuff like that. Does that, you know, like, does that hold up, or are we, you know, are we still in that kind of world, or is that just kind of like, eh, you know, that's there, but it's really, everything's just a hook for kind of the close and this idea that you can transform yourself in virtual reality?
Well, at this point, I think the Matrix has ended up being resonant in maybe ways that even the filmmakers at the time didn't anticipate. You know, the sort of the anxiety over artificial intelligence and what it might eventually do to us, its creators, I feel like that's still very firmly in the realm of fantasy. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, that's something that was being explored at the time. I mean, there was quite literally that movie AI, but also iRobot and other, you know, other entities like kind of questioning the wisdom of, you know, what if we make consciousness and we put it in a machine? You know, and that was an interesting question. But I don't think that people are, I mean, at this point, people are more concerned that our AIs are racist, which is sort of funny to me. But, you know, but the racism of the AIs is really all about them being developed by human beings with blind spots. It's like we cannot eschew the human error that's baked into whatever it is we make, even if what we're making is supposed to ultimately be more powerful than we are. So that's a long-winded way of saying that I don't think that that's really the thing that makes the Matrix compelling at this point. I think that actually it's what it says about identity, because at the time, you know, the idea of reinventing yourself in virtual space, that was a dream, but it wasn't something you could really do. I mean, maybe there were some folks who were sort of intrepid and early adopters who were like catfishing on AOL. But I don't
Certainly if you had an instant AIM, you know, AOL instant messaging, that's pretty much, that was a big catfish pond. Yeah.
Yeah, you can confess now that you were one of the catfish.
Maybe I was one of the, I don't know, who is the, was I the fisher or the fish? I don't know. You know,
I don't know. I have trouble. Did you ever type A/S/L, age, sex, location, into a chat box?
I have never done that. No. No, I did not.
This was a very formative part of, I think, the elder millennial online experience.
And suddenly the other books you have written, which often takes place or have a chunk of kind of weird, you know, kind of text-based technology communication in them, starts to become clear. So,
right.
You know, the identity stuff is interesting too, because at the end of the 90s, I mean, in many ways, it seemed more hopeful than today. I mean, if today everything is kind of dire and, you know, either the planet is about to burn up or, you know, we are realizing now that America has never been more racist, sexist, classist, homophobic, et cetera, xenophobic. in the late 90s, there was a kind of burst of optimism that people could become individuals because we had shaken off, you know, the worst of, you know, of kind of racism and sexism. Women were flourishing. Minorities were flourishing. The Soviet Union was gone. So we didn't have to kind of subjugate our personal identity in the fight against communism. Like everybody could take a breath. I always think of, for me, the late 90s is, what's his name? Tiger Woods, who is now known probably to people of your age, mostly as like a, you know, a sex offender. at the time, this was all before that had happened, and he used to call himself a Kablanasian. He was a Caucasian, Black, Indian, like Native American as well as South Asian. And he called himself a Kablanasian, and he was kind of like the poster boy for a new world where you could be a minority of one, and that made you more interesting, and you could kind of focus on different parts of you. And it seems to me some of that is at play and kind of the power of the Matrix.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at this point, one of the ways to kind of claim power online is to express your affiliation with as many different minority and usually marginalized / victimized groups as possible, which is why you see people with their mental illnesses tagged in their profile, which I continue to find fascinating. But it's interesting to think that the 90s was a period of optimism in this respect, when so much of the filmmaking of the time and the movies that especially came out in the year 1999 were really focused on the idea of having become like a society drone. And it was like, is that all there is? You had Office Space and Fight Club and American Beauty. All of these films that were in one way or another about the sort of emptiness of a modern liberated life.
Yeah, that talk about those, because Office Space, I would say, and it might, obviously it depends on the person you're talking to. In a lot of ways, I'd say The Matrix and Office Space are the two longest lived movies of that year. Office Space seemed to capture something about the banality of like working in the future, right? The company is InnoTech or whatever. And, and it's the worst kind of cubicle life possible, even as these are people who are doing computer-based stuff. And that critique seems to still have a lot of sting, even if, now people are working in fancier offices because of Google and Facebook and stuff like that. Do you think, Fight Club gets talked about a lot? Do you think, and in a way, that was also a very culturally powerful movie. People still talk about it. People still say, the one rule of Fight Club, they use that line over and over again. What do you think the long tail lesson of Fight Club or Office Space is?
Well, Office Space I find interesting because you also have the character played by Jennifer Aniston. I don't remember her name in the movie, but she's such a sort of an early subversive critique of the idea of bringing your whole self to work, where companies would be like, we want you to express your individuality. And all she wants is to show up to her job. And she is forced to put flair, pieces of flair, right, on her uniform to express herself flair, as a person. Yeah. Yeah. And then she comes under fire for not having enough flair. And right. They're like, why are you only doing the bare minimum? And she's like, do you want me to do more? And they're like, well, no, we want you to want to do more. Right. So there's this fundamental tension between the idea of your job as your identity as opposed to just something you do to make money. So that's Office Space. Fight Club has alarmingly become I should just admit up front that it's one of my favorite movies. I still love it. And yet it's developed this reputation for being kind of a red flag. Like if you find this in the DVD collection of somebody that you're dating, you're supposed to run the other way because of the toxic masculinity and the nihilism of it.
Right.
And I do think that, The Matrix and Fight Club are in certain ways two sides of the same coin, but The Matrix maybe expresses something more hopeful than Fight Club does. And maybe that's why people feel more comfortable remaining invested in it all these years later.
Yeah. I'll throw another movie in, which I don't think you mentioned in the essay, but in preparing for this conversation, The Sixth Sense also came out in 1999. And that what I think what ties that together, and this is something I want to ask you about, is like, you know, that all of these movies kind of take place in a world where there is the surface level and then there is the dark secret that gets revealed, that, you know, if you're just floating through life, you are not understanding what's going on. You are, you know, in the Matrix parlance, you are blue-pilled in The Sixth Sense. And I think it's safe now to do a spoiler alert, but the Bruce Willis character realizes that he is the dead person and the world around him is alive. Yes. You know, now doesn't it make more sense now? Doesn't it make more sense? but that also seems, and I guess this goes to the, you know, the main metaphor from The Matrix is, you know, the idea of being red-pilled, where you're given a choice to either, you know, kind of plunge into the world as it really is, what reality is, which is brutal and harsh and demands some kind of heroic struggle, or you can say blue-pilled and just kind of be anesthetized and just go about your life. Why do you think that is, you know, that is so powerful, a kind of motif or a meme?
Well, everybody loves the idea of, you know, being a member of the enlightened amongst sheep, right? So that's certainly got to be part of it. I think also people really fell in love with the idea of being countercultural, being kind of punk, you know, which is what being red-pilled was in many ways about. But it then expressed itself in the form of, okay, now I'm countercultural, so I'm going to go to the mall and I'm going to go to Hot Topic and buy a shirt that says, I do whatever the voices in my head tell me to do. So as soon as you had this desire to be sort of a member of the counterculture, then immediately capitalism stepped in and was like, oh, here, yeah, you know, you can buy that identity for $5. I think that's maybe something that Fight Club was being more critical of than The Matrix.
I mean, and
maybe
certainly the novel. The novel Fight Club, Chuck Palahniuk, or however, I'm mispronouncing his name, but
Chuck Palahniuk.
I mean, he is a really turgid, by the numbers critic of consumerism, right? And the original Fight Club was darker than the movie, even, which, because the movie kind of has a kind of upbeat ending. I don't know.
I mean, they're holding hands as the world burns down, so there is that.
But they're able to set off the bombs, right? You know, whereas in China, I mean,
zero.
Yeah, this has been, I guess, in the news lately, China has apparently, censors in China changed the ending of Fight Club, which is, of course, different than the novel. So Hollywood changed the ending of Fight Club as well. But in China, it cuts out before all the bombs go off and it says everybody involved was arrested. So, you know, that's like kind of a happy ending for the Chinese. Before we continue with the recent interview, let me tell you about BetterHelp Online Therapy, one of this podcast's sponsors. Are you feeling stressed out, run down, anxious, short-tempered? If you are, take the time to take care of yourself by going to betterhelp.com/TRI and start talking to a licensed therapist who won't judge you, but will listen and help you with your problems, whatever they are. That's BETTERHELP.com/TRI for the recent interview. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. So you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with a therapist in under 48 hours. And all these people are licensed. This is the real deal. If you don't like your first therapist, switch to another, all without the hassle of driving across town and sitting in a waiting room. I know it's a great service because I used it myself for well over a year. If you need to talk it out, and these days we all do, go to betterhelp.com/TRI and get 10% off your first month. And now, back to the recent interview. What do you think about the critiques of consumerism? Because I agree, and I, you know, as a libertarian and as a consumer, I kind of like the idea. It's shallow, but I kind of like the idea that, yeah, you can go to Hot Topic and you can buy, you know, misfits vans and you know, with the red ghost face on them. And you can buy bondage clothes even if you don't know what it is. Is that such a bad thing that you can just kind of pick stuff up without really knowing what it is?
No, I don't think so. I mean, also, it's kind of interesting that in the Matrix, the people who've been unplugged in the real world, they dress like shit, you know, like mm-hmm. they wear rags, they eat goop. It's right. like a very ascetic existence. And then if they want to express themselves, it's not until they plug back into this place that's not real that they're wearing their cool clothes and they've got their sunglasses and that it can actually have sort of an individual aesthetic that is cool. And, you know, I guess maybe there's something to be said there about the luxury of being able to express yourself, you know, when you're out there in the real world and you're just scrabbling for survival against all these sentient machines, you know, you don't have time to put on your leather hot pants and look really cool. I think that there's so much to play with there in the identity thing, the question of, you know, the self you construct online that is more interesting and better looking and better dressed and stronger and faster and all, you know, just appealing in every way, more so than the person you actually are in the real world.
And I guess one of the big differences, obviously, people always did that. People, you know, when they wrote, I mean, an early internet joke was, you know, online, nobody knows you're a dog. And they meant that both kind of literally and figuratively. And I guess the difference is now we can actually live online more. Right. More especially in a pandemic, you know, where we're talking, you know, via, you know, super fancy machines that allow us to communicate over, you know, hundreds of miles and visually as well. So that becomes a kind of interesting thing that you can escape into the Matrix. Can I ask you one kind of large interpretation of the Matrix also has to do with reading through the kind of life journey of the directors of the first one, and then one of Lana Wachowski, who directed Matrix Resurrections, but they started, you know, they were the Wachowski brothers when they made the first three Matrix movies, and now they are the Wachowski sisters, and that it's read as a kind of allegory or having something to do with trans identity of people leaving the body that they don't feel comfortable in and entering, you know, a different body of their own making. That seems kind of like an interesting and powerful read, right?
Yeah, for certain. I can't imagine, assuming that the Wachowskis had an inkling at the time that they were writing this movie of the identity transformation that was to come. I'm sure that that stuff is latent in the story, not by accident. I definitely think that some commentators on the movie are trying to shoehorn that narrative in a way that's much more explicit than it's actually there. You know, sort of like J.K. Rowling kind of retroactively, oh, by the way, Dumbledore's gay, you know?
Totally gay. Aggressively gay. Yeah. No, it's I am looking forward to one of the reasons I want to live to be 200 is to see what further trolling she does of her audience, especially now that they have, you know, all of the actors have turned against her. She's got a lot of scores to settle. So I can only imagine what kind of revelations J.K. Rowling is going to be leaking out over the next 20 or 30 years.
Yeah. Hopefully we both live to see that.
One of the, one of the interesting points, though, if you look at that kind of trans interpretation, and I agree, I'm sure it was, you know, somehow working in the heads of the creators, not in an explicit way, but in a kind of inchoate way, perhaps. But, you know, your essay talks a lot about this, that the virtual world, though, is, you know, it's cooler, like you look better and, you know, you can, you know, kick people's asses and dodge bullets and jump off of buildings and things. But there's really no physicality there. It's kind of a weird world, and it's not like, you know, most people think, oh, well, I go online or I go to an imagined world and I do a lot of drugs and I fuck everything that moves or something. And like, they don't even eat really, right? In the Matrix, in the simulation.
Yeah, the only person who eats, the only person who is seen enjoying food is Cypher, the bad guy, as he's having, you know, he's having his Judas meal with the machines and he's eating a steak and he's loving the hell out of it. Yeah, the Matrix actually, it seems to take a very, you know, it's all about liberty, but it also is a movie that loathes libertinism.
Right. It's and disembodied, literally and figuratively, yeah.
Yeah, nobody has sex in the Matrix. It's implied that you could. There's this woman in the red dress who's like, but she's not a person. She's a program. And that's fascinating too. It's like all the sex that anybody is having in this liberated world is with something that's not actually real. So I think that's especially, the sexlessness of the movie is fascinating to me, especially because of the BDSM aesthetics. It's like, and I think that's a kind of a precursor to something that's happened now where you can identify into all of these sexual, like sexualities, sexual minorities, sexual identities without ever having fucked anybody. That's fascinating. It's like, yeah. It's completely divorced from the physical act or even this from physical desire.
Yeah, it's a weird kind of variation on what Erica Jong called the zipless fuck in Fear of Flying, where it's like perfect sex that never takes place. So I can be a bunch of different sexual orientations without ever actually having to kind of go through with that. It's weird. And that is a really interesting kind of anticipation of like where we seem to be today. Having said that, love matters, right? Both in The Matrix and in The Matrix Resurrections, it's a love story ultimately between Neo and Trinity, between Keanu Reeves and Carrie Ann Moss. But it doesn't feel very compelling because there isn't that kind of physical frisson.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, they certainly had chemistry in the first movie. And I think that they did play it well in the Resurrections movie, you know, where they're sort of encountering each other with no memory of each other, but a sense of what was. That was one of the parts of the movie that I liked. I also liked that they'd given her the name Tiffany, which she hates.
You know, what are there any movies that have come out recently or novels or TV shows, do you think, that are going to kind of displace The Matrix as a kind of, you know, just a text that we speak through, which though is fascinating for me. In preparing for this, I was thinking about the movies before The Matrix and in very different ways. A movie like The Godfather created a language that is still kind of being used, and it doesn't have anything. It's about identity, I guess, in a way, but it's not about kind of virtual stuff or technology. It's about criminality versus responsible businessmen, about changing the immigrant narrative, into like I say this as somebody who's part Italian American, and it was the boldness of taking the Italian immigrant story and then saying it's the mafia story and that is the American narrative is pretty bold and pretty exciting. And that's been co-opted. Al Pacino alone has played, he's played the Italian version of Michael Corleone, the Cuban version, a Jewish version. Like, he is just able to keep it going. But, is there a movie or a text or anything right now that you think is kind of setting up what we're going to be talking about or how we're going to be talking about things for the next decade or so?
I don't think that it's possible to predict that, because the Matrix was resonant, not just because of what it was when it came out, but because of what happened after that made it prescient, maybe without even intending to be. I mean, I don't think that the Wachowskis could have possibly known how much identity and life was going to eventually move into virtual space. So much of what you see in the movie it was completely impossible. There wasn't even really a dream of it at the time. To think about the fact that it came out even before, there was no social media back then. So it was a completely, just a different world. So it's hard to imagine what, I think that the question will be where we go from here kind of culturally, that we then maybe look back on something from this moment and say, oh, that was actually an inflection point. We pivoted from there. I'm not sure, whatever it is it going to be something that is, you know, that dwells as much in a sort of a technical and digital space as The Matrix did? Because I think we've reached this point where, you know, we've all moved online and we've been living online for, you know, almost 20 years and are starting to really bump up against the limitations of that. And we're starting to see how, you know, our relationships with each other are impacted by spending too much time in digital space with a screen as an intermediary. And I look at things like Euphoria, which is a show that I don't really understand the appeal of, but it has a lot to do with obviously drugs, and it has a lot to do with, you know, kind of altered consciousness, but also with, you know, sort of meat space relationships. You know, you cannot do drugs online. Yes. Yeah,
it's a very moist, wet show. It's bodies slapping up against each other. It seems very humid.
I think maybe there's something about that, that, you know, are, like, is there this yearning to get back to like the physical and the moist and the messy?
Right. Yeah, it's very messy. And it is, yeah, you know, the other thing about Euphoria, I think it's also probably important or worth thinking about, like, it's set in a high school, but it's obviously not for high schoolers. Nobody went to a high school like that. And it's kind of like when you're out of high school and you start thinking about, oh, what might have been or what it should have been like. But it's also, it's a fairly terrifying world, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. You know, I was trying to last week was National School Choice Week, which Reason participates in. We celebrate all varieties of school choice. And I was trying to, you know, do something using Euphoria as like a case for school choice. I don't know if it's a good case or a negative case, but
I thought you were going to say you wanted to open a high school that was like the one in Euphoria.
A charter school, if you're in, you know, like we can get, you know, I don't know, $8,000 per student. I think we could do a better job, you know, than a conventional high school. Let's talk about your novel that came out last fall. No One Will Miss Her. It's a mystery thriller. It got great reviews. And it got a really great Plum nomination for an award that I want to talk about in a second. But could you summarize the plot, you know, without giving away anything, obviously? You're the author, so you know where all the bodies are buried. You know which character you're going to retroactively reveal as gay or straight or asexual. But give us the plot.
Okay, so No One Will Miss Her is opens on a beautiful October morning in rural Maine, where a small town junkyard is on fire and the town pariah, a woman named Lizzie Willette, is dead. And you know that she's dead because she's the person who's speaking to you at the beginning of the book. She's narrating from beyond the grave. So from there, the story travels back in time. You understand who Lizzie was and how she came to be deceased, murdered. You follow in real time also the police officer who's investigating the case. And then another woman, Adrienne Richards, who is connected to this murder in ways that are eventually revealed, but that I will not describe here.
I will, and I hope you take this as the compliment I mean it as, I think of it as Sally Rooney meets the Lovely Bones. It's because the dialogue is like phenomenal, and the pacing and the foreshadowing and the twists are all fantastic. And, you know, and then it's got like this mystery right at the center of it. I mean, really just a powerful book, a great book. And I hope people, you know, listening to this, give it a try, you know, on Kindle or at your local bookstore or whatever. What is it like to be nominated? I mean, you're nominated for the best novel of the year by the Edgar Allan Poe Awards. How does that make you feel?
Very excited. Yeah. You know, this is something that I had hoped might happen, but I didn't really dare to hope too much because, it's a big deal. It's the sort of the biggest deal thing that can happen to you as a mystery writer. So I'm stoked. And supposedly there's going to be a real awards ceremony at which I'll get to eat real steak and wear an actual dress. So yeah, pretty stoked.
And then, you know, and show real disappointment or real, you know, unbelievable, you know, happiness, right? If you win.
Yeah. Yeah. The possibility of winning and having to speak in public is terrifying to me. So I don't know. Am I hoping that I win? I guess I'll probably get over that. Yeah. If I win.
I assume though that it's typical that, you know, when you're a finalist for an Edgar, you know, people start disappearing, right? Like the other finalists, somebody is knocking everybody off, right? I mean, it's got to be a plot for a book yet to be written.
You know, I think the thing is that if you were in the finals for the Edgars and then your other competitors start to die off, that's not really a whodunit. Everyone is going to know whodunit. It was you.
Yeah, come on. I can think of a thousand plot twists, but okay. You know, here is a great plot twist for you. You write a lot about, you know, kind of wokeness and culture and the way it's intersecting with things like young adult novels and other forms of literary expression. But you were on CNN recently to talk about Neil Young versus Joe Rogan versus Spotify. And I'm, you know, I want to squeeze every drop of, you know, juice I can get out of this story. And I think we may be approaching the limit. You don't know. But you were on Reliable Sources, the Brian Stelter show, and you very clearly were critiquing legacy media people because you were on a panel where it was, you know, the host and another guest saying, you know, like Joe Rogan is, you know, is evil. Joe Rogan is, you know, causing hundreds of thousands of people to die, more or less, and that it's really up to places like CNN and legacy media to protect people from the misinformation that's going there. And you very clearly said, you know, like regardless of what happens with Joe Rogan, people still are not going to trust or rely on CNN or traditional media. What happened next?
Well, this was my first live TV interview, and after what I experienced.
Oh, I didn't realize. That's fantastic. Wow, you really hit it out of the park.
I'm never doing it again.
Yeah. Oh, you need to. You need to. But
oh, it was brutal. Apparently, so, you know, in the course of trying to be critical, you know, apparently too subtle and too dry a way, I talked about how, you know, I unfortunately used the word we, which people took to mean me as opposed to like we in the media. I talked about how everybody is sort of haunted by the specter of this guy, you know, this imaginary guy who's listening to Rogan and internalizing everything he hears on the show and then going out and making bad decisions. I don't believe that this guy exists,
right.
But I was sort of trying to explain that, you know, clearly people are afraid of this. But that, yeah, you know, nevertheless, it's doesn't make sense to censor him, that he's sprung up as, you know, an extremely popular entity in an independent space, that he's giving people something that they want they're not getting from legacy media. And that if you kicked him off Spotify, which is what Neil Young was attempting to do, that he would not suffer remotely, and more importantly, people would not go seeking out like the CNNs and New York Timeses of the world to get their news instead. So people, I do believe that people who watched CNN understood what was being said here. People who watched a clip that was pulled out of me talking about, again, in a sort of a dry, sarcastic way, those of us who consider ourselves more enlightened and find Joe Rogan frightening. This was a clip that circulated online through all of the worst corners of the internet where dark and terrible people live. And I became, for the first time in my life, the object of a right-wing outrage campaign. Usually I get it from the left, but this time it was, you know, very, very unhappy Rogan fans.
I want to read some of the quotes, the tweets that you very helpfully kind of compiled and put on your Twitter feed, which is at Kat Rosenfield. Everybody should check it out. Fuck off, SeaWorld. We the people are going to stomp the fuck out of the Demotard party in 2022 and finish the job in 2024. But on the bright side, your drivel might have actually reached all 10 watchers of the Communist News Network. In closing, go get yourself laid, C-word. It will likely free up your clogged brain. And that's not even the worst. Another one referred to as a Zionist pig. Are you a Zionist pig, or is, I mean, I don't know where that came out from.
You know, I have a suspicion that that man's problem is not really with Israel. I think it might be something else.
Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, how does that make you feel? You know, obviously there's a, you know, there's just kind of a ridiculousness to all of that. But, you know, and also I can imagine, especially if that's your first time on TV, and then to get this kind of, you know, just, you know, fire hose of kind of contempt, that's so bizarre that it's kind of comical. But does it make you feel better or worse about the country you live in and, you know, kind of the internet?
Oh, I think I would be very unwise to try to extrapolate from this experience mm-hmm. any broader conclusions about the country that I live in. You know, these are a handful of really maladjusted people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been the subject of online draggings before. What's sort of interesting about when the left comes after you, you tend not to get angry emails, although I understand that maybe this is a different experience for other people who mm-hmm. are not me. But nobody ever bothers to actually reach out to me. It's very much about performatively bullying me for the benefit of, like, you know, their own platform, their own self-aggrandizement, and all their friends join in, and it's like this party. So yeah, the difference getting targeted by the right is that I am getting a lot of personal emails from men who appear to want to harm me mm-hmm. or, you know, so like, I can't say that I love it. You know, I get a little frisson of like, oh God, when I see another one come in. But yeah, I don't really think that it means anything except that, you know, we're all too online right now, and some folks have too much time on their hands and a lot of unspent anger. So
maybe you can take the afternoon off and drive by your local high school and see if there's like a euphoria party going. You know, you got to say euphoria is good because, you know, age is not a restriction there. You know, they have young kids and older people, married people, single people. It's a world that is very inclusive in terms of its perversions. So, you know, maybe yeah. you can, well, maybe you can discover that.
Yeah, I was saying that, you know, of all the weeks, this had to be the one where I ran out of drugs. So, you know, very unfortunate for me on that front.
Do you think, are we reaching any kind of, I don't know if it's a tipping point, if it's a reset or anything? You talked about how, like, you know, everybody's really online. We've obviously been locked down in various ways for essentially 2 years now. Things open up, things close again, all of that kind of stuff. Do you think we're reaching a point where we're going to actually kind of like jump, as maybe they do in the Matrix, where we're going to be able to make a leap from the top of this building to another building where something else is going on, where things settle down a little bit? Or do you think this is the new normal, where we're just going to be kind of in a really, you know, pretty dumb level of discourse for the rest of our lives?
Gosh, that's a depressing thought. I hope it's not that. But yeah, I'm sort of afraid to make predictions. I see people who I trust and I think are intelligent suggesting that maybe we're reaching a tipping point with this stuff. I think, for instance, well, there was this recent thing that happened with West Elm Caleb, you know, who's an ordinary mm-hmm. dude who was dating on, I guess, maybe Hinge or Tinder. And some young women on TikTok got together to basically drag his name through the mud. And, you know, he's like one human man upon whom the entire ire of the internet just rained down. And then there was, I think, you know, in a way that there wouldn't necessarily have been just a few years ago, this sort of reset from the media, from outlets that would have been cheering this on, like, you know, that contributed, for instance, to the takedown of Justine Seko back in 2015 or whenever that
and
was.
She's the she's like kind of the patient zero of online shaming, what became known as cancel culture.
Exactly.
Who had said famously was a PR lady. I'm sorry, just a backfill for people whose memories are, you know, are shrunken by either too many drugs or not enough drugs. I'm never sure which. But was it, I believe she was like a PR executive or something, but she was traveling to Africa. And she said, I'm going to, when she started her flight, she said, I'm going to Africa. Hope I don't get AIDS. Just kidding. I'm white. And by the time she landed, was it like 10 or 12 hours later, her entire life was destroyed. So we,
and I mean, this was a self-deprecating joke that didn't land. So that was really just, I mean, it's in so many ways was a precursor to the culture that we live in now. Like that was the writing on the wall right there. But the West Elm Caleb thing, you know, even as this guy was getting dragged all over the internet, you had places like Slate or BuzzFeed coming back and saying, well, this is actually just, you know, one random guy. It's not fair to treat him as an avatar for every disappointing man in the world. You know, maybe it's actually damaging to whip up a massive online mob globally against one individual person. So stuff like that suggests that maybe, yeah, you know, maybe we're dialing back on this a little bit. On the other hand, in the sort of the professions where it matters most, whatever you want to call it, I mean, I hate the word cancel culture, but I don't really know how else to describe it. This, you know, this surveilling, snitching, punitive approach that's so rooted not really in genuine concern for, you know, justice as a cause, but more often in professional jealousy and, you know, sort of the bucket of crabs mentality where someone's trying to scrape for a little bit of something for themselves. This is on display continuously in journalism, in academia, increasingly in medicine, in the sciences. I mean, it's just everywhere, and it's deeply depressing. So I'll be optimistic when I see us turn a corner. For instance, when like people who work at legacy media, when people who work at legacy media outlets aren't behaving in public online under their real names like a bunch of eighth grade mean girls.
Yeah. It's, and I'll just point out earlier today, the day that we're recording this, Wednesday, February 2nd, the head of CNN just stepped down after there was an investigation into the way that Chris Cuomo, Andrew Cuomo's brother, the broadcaster who got kicked out for various improper actions. And the head of CNN, as part of that investigation, a consensual workplace relationship came to light, and he has stepped down. So is that turning the corner, or is that kind of blowing a bigger hole in the lifeboat?
I would say bigger hole in the lifeboat, a consensual relationship, and he stepped down.
Yeah, apparently he was supposed to, he should have told HR about it.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that he had to step down because my segment was so bad.
That would be, I don't know, would that be a good thing, a good sign or a bad sign? I don't know, you know.
Probably not.
Well, how much,
No, it's
you know,
strange that it's become so taboo to have these, you know, relationships at work where about one third of the country used to meet their spouses. That's a new norm that I wonder if it will stick, because I think that successfully making that taboo has had results and ripple effects out into the, sort of the dating economy that people don't really like. So we'll see.
Right. Yeah. Because obviously you probably share a lot of interests with people that you work with, you know, for obvious reasons. So it's a place that you would expect people to get together. Do you think that the way another outrage du jour besides Neil Young versus Joe Rogan, and there, you know, the question wasn't that Neil Young didn't want to be associated with Joe Rogan, it's that he kind of said, Spotify, you either have me or you have Rogan, you can't have both, which is odd. But Whoopi Goldberg, the talk show host on The View, former stand-up comedian, actress, Academy Award winner, just got put on ice for a couple of weeks because she had kind of bizarrely insisted that the that the Holocaust had nothing to do with race or racial animus because the Nazis and Jews were both white. But is that like, I mean, should we even care about this kind of stuff? Obviously, she's an idiot for saying that. She's apologized. She apologized in a way that, like many of these apologies, dug her hole a little bit deeper. But she's suspended for 2 weeks. She's going to come back. She said other things, you know, similar to this. You know, what's the best way forward? Do we just stop paying attention to this? Do we just, when we hear something we think is stupid, we say that's stupid and then move on? You know, how do we change this dynamic?
It's such a strange thing that, you know, people want content like this. You know, people want unscripted, off the cuff conversations between people who are speaking extemporaneously and being, you know, being spontaneous, maybe being a little too honest. And then when they get what they wanted, they flip out. And it's, you know, I think that there's obviously tension there. It's like you were getting what you asked for. Joe Rogan is another good example of this. You know, he has these conversations. They're very, very popular because they're off the cuff in this way, you know, because they're not particularly scripted or prepared for. I think people really hate this canned stuff that we're getting. It feels sort of condescending. And so, yeah, I don't really know what the way forward is except to tell people to calm down. You know, if you want this type of content, if you want the view on television, then you're going to have to content yourself with the possibility that somebody speaking, you know, in real time might say something a little dumb.
Well, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Kat Rosenfield, the author most recently of the Edgar-nominated mystery thriller, No One Will Miss Her, a kind of CNN cause celeb for at least the next couple of hours. Congratulations on that. And the author of a fantastic essay in a recent issue of Reason that's up on our website, reason.com, about the Matrix and its cultural staying power. Kat, is there anything else that you want people to know about you, or where should they go to follow your various activities?
I'm mainly on Twitter, as much as I hate to say it. So yeah, Twitter at Kat Rosenfield, just my name, and you can find me there.
All right. Thank you so much. It's been really wonderful talking.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
This has been The Reason Interview. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.